So someone asked me recently what my favorite memoir was, and I felt like I waited like 30 seconds before I said, and the whole time I'm thinking, it's Tender Bar, right? The Tender Bar by J.R. Moringer. But the reason I was hesitating was because I kept thinking about this book, Drinking a Love Story by Caroline Knapp, and I didn't want to say it because I had just finished it, so I didn't know if it was just recency bias, but now that I have gone through all my notes and prepared for this podcast episode, I can say with certainty that this is my new favorite memoir. It was similar to The Tender Bar in some ways, in that I highlighted so much of this book. And when I did the Tender Bar episode, I highlighted so much of that book. So there was like, it took me forever to go through everything, like entire pages sometimes. In the same way that I highlighted that book, I would just underline so much, and I didn't know why I was underlining it, other than I just thought that the writing, something about the passages were just resonating with me so much. And on that first pass, for both of them, I just thought it was because of the content, because I resonated so much with the story. But as I learned with the Tender Bar, and I learned with this book, it's not just the story or the content or that I feel, you know, a kinship with these writers. It's the way that they write, and there are very specific things that they do, and it's so fucking exciting to be able to break this stuff down and then translate what I've learned to my own writing. Okay, so here's something else. This is something different that we're going to do today. Right after I finished this book, or like as I was finishing this book, I started reading this other book, which is not a memoir. It's called The Elements of Eloquence by Mark Forsyth. And it's a book about writing, and specifically it's about figures of rhetoric, which I didn't even know what figures of rhetoric were. I still don't really know. It's like figures of speech. Sam bought this book. He told me that I would like it. So I was like, okay, let me check this thing out. So I realized that what Mark Forsyth was doing with Elements of Eloquence, with these terms, he was putting names to the things that I was highlighting. But there were some terms in this book that I had never heard of. And we are going to talk about some of those today. And there are five that I'm going to talk about. And the five elements of eloquence that I'm going to talk about are anaphora, epistrophe, diacope, parataxis, and pleonasm. And yes, I had to Google the pronunciation for some of these. And I have never heard of these words before. But don't worry, I'm going to break these down. And I'll even spell them for you because I didn't know how to spell them. I'm going to break these down so that when we are finished going through these, you will be able and eager to use these tricks in your own writing, because that's how I feel. And I had so many things to talk about today, like so many more notes, but these five things that we're going to go over today were so fucking cool that I decided to just focus on these terms from the Elements of Eloquence and how they came up in Caroline Knapp's book, Drinking a Love Story. So I hope this isn't confusing, because I'm going to be talking about the book Elements of Eloquence, and I'm going to be talking about the book Drinking a Love Story and how they relate to each other. This is going to be really fun. Okay, let's get started. The first figure of rhetoric is called anaphora. Anaphora is spelled A-N-A-P-H-O-R-A. And anaphora is when you start each sentence with the same word or words, or each clause with the same word or words, or each paragraph with the same word or words. So here's an example. On page 3, she writes, I drank when I was happy, and I drank when I was anxious, and I drank when I was bored, and I drank when I was depressed, which was often. So you can see that the anaphora here is I drank when. And you can see it kind of rolls off the tongue, and it feels like a poem almost. It's very like sing-songy. And the thing that Mark Forsyth says in Elements of Eloquence is that anaphora is dangerous because people always remember the opening words, but they usually forget the rest. So you have to be intentional with using anaphora. And I think that she was very intentional here, because the words that she's using here are pretty generic words. Happy, anxious, bored, depressed. Like, these are common things. And I think that's the point. The point is that she drank all the time, no matter what she was feeling. She's making that point that no matter what was going on for her, she drank. So this is such a beautiful way of using anaphora. So as I read these lines, I'm on page 3, just started the book, and I understand this term anaphora. I realized that J.R. Moringer in the Tender Bar did this all the time. But when I did that episode, back on episode 30, if you guys want to check that one out, all I did was call it repetition. What I learned from this book, Elements of Eloquence, is that there's so many types of repetition. And in fact, the next two things I'm going to talk about are both types of repetition. But we're still going to stay with anaphora. So let me, I'm actually going to just give this example from the Tender Bar, because he also starts with the line, not I drank when, but I drank. So on page 342 of the Tender Bar, J.R. Moringer writes, I drank to get drunk. I drank because I couldn't think what else to do. I drank the way Steve drank at the end to achieve oblivion. So I wanted to point this one out because it's very similar, except that, and the first two were pretty generic. I drank to get drunk. I drank because I couldn't think what else to do. But then the last thing that he lists is the longer specific thing. I drank the way Steve drank at the end to achieve oblivion. And Steve was a person in his life who he looked up to and who died in large part because of drinking. So this is like a, you know, he has this anaphora, I drank. And then the last one is like a bam, and he hits you with it so that it really, you really get the punch of this last line, as opposed to him just skipping the first two and just going right to, I drank the way Steve drank at the end to achieve oblivion. And I also wanted to point out that anaphora does not have to be an entire phrase. It could just be one word. So in these first two, it was first, I drank when, and then the second one was, I drank. But, and I love how Mark describes it here. He says, with just one word, the effect is slightly less powerful, but beautifully hypnotic. And I read this line in his book, and I was just like, oh my God, that is how I felt about most of this book by Caroline Knapp. I felt like the writing was beautifully hypnotic, and now I know why. It's because she used so much anaphora. So I'll give you an example here where she just had one word at the start. On page 19, she writes, real alcoholics drank themselves straight out of jobs. They got loaded at lunch and never came back to the office. They were so hungover they couldn't get to work in the first place. They stashed gin in their desks and received repeated warnings about their failing job performance. And they were finally fired. I wasn't like that, not in the least. So the anaphora here is they. They got loaded. They were so hungover. They stashed gin. They were finally fired. So it's subtle, but it works, and it just really kept my eyes on the page. And by the way, all of my, so I, you guys know how I do my notes. I just underline stuff in the book and then I transcribe it into my Evernote. Then I pull Evernote into a Google Doc, and I'm just going through all of my notes and I'm trying to figure out like what I'm going to talk about for today's episode. And the first like entire page I realized was anaphora. I am not even kidding you. There's so much anaphora. And I was just like, oh my God, this is crazy, because when I pull stuff over, I'm not like, oh, this has some kind of repetition, and so I want to talk about this. No, I don't think about repetition at all. I just think, wow, this passage really stood out to me. I wonder why. And then I see it and I'm just like, I'm always blown away that it's always so simple. Okay, here's one more and then we'll move on. But this was another example where she just used one word and it really felt beautifully hypnotic. On page 106, she writes, you buy, you edge home with your large brown bag, you lock the door behind you, and only then can you relax. So the anaphora here is you, and I love how it's second person. It feels so like personal. But you know, without the anaphora, she could have just written, you buy, edge home with your large brown bag, lock the door behind you, and only then can you relax. And that would have worked just as well, not just as well, it would have worked the same way, would have gotten the same message across. But when she does you before every single thing, you buy, you edge home with your large brown bag, you lock the door behind you, and only then can you relax, it feels like I'm singing the sentence. Okay, let's move on to another form of repetition, which is called epistrophe. Epistrophe, I had to Google how to say this one, is spelled E-P-I-S-T-R-O-P-H-E. And epistrophe is pretty much the opposite of anaphora. It's when you end each sentence with the same word, or you end each clause with the same word, or you end each paragraph with the same word. So I'm going to read this little passage to you that I loved, and then we can talk about it. So here she is mentioning her friend Elaine, which was just one of her drinking buddies who was always drunker than her. On page 8, she writes, "But some small part of me, it got larger over the years, was always secretly relieved to see Elaine that way. A messy drunk's an ugly thing, particularly when the messy drunk's a woman, and I could compare myself to her and feel superiority and relief. I wasn't that bad. No way was I that bad. And I wasn't that bad. I had lots of rules. I never drank in the morning and I never drank at work. And except for an occasional white wine, maybe two with lunch on days when I didn't have to do too much in the afternoon, except for an occasional zip across the street from work to the Chinese restaurant with a colleague, I always abided by them." Okay, so let's talk about it. First, the epistrophe. I don't know if you guys picked up on it, but the epistrophe was "that bad." So in the very beginning, she writes, "I wasn't that bad. No way was I that bad. And I wasn't that bad." So it's three sentences. Actually, the first sentence is has a semicolon between it. So "I wasn't that bad," semicolon. "No way was I that bad," period. And then a new sentence, "and I wasn't that bad." And I love how she places the emphasis on the first two. It's on that. And then in the third line, there's no emphasis. And then we switch it up and we move to anaphora. And she's got two anaphoras in here. She's got "I never" and then "except for an occasional." So "I never drank in the morning and I never drank at work." And then she switches to "except for an occasional." "Except for an occasional white wine, maybe two with lunch. Except for an occasional zip across the street from work to the Chinese restaurant." So this is loaded with repetition and a very specific kind of repetition. Okay, let's move on to the third and last form of repetition that I'm going to talk about today, which is diacopy. Diacopy is spelled D-I-A-C-O-P-E, and this shit blew my mind. And I just like want to use this all the time now. So diacopy is a word or phrase that is repeated after a brief interruption. And in the book Elements of Eloquence, he gives you some movie examples. So I'll just say these real quick. Bond, James Bond. Run, Toto, run. Zed's dead, baby. Zed's dead. So just like anaphora, so many of my notes that I highlighted had diacopies in them. So just to give you a quick example, on page 92, she writes, "The hard things in life, the things you really learn from, happen with a clear mind." Okay, so the diacopy here is "things." The hard things in life, the things you really learn from. So she repeats that word after a brief interruption. So I tried to do this in my newsletter I just published this morning. I was just like, you know, throwing diacopies anywhere I could. So here was one I did. I wrote, "I don't remember how I acted. I only remember feeling like I survived it." So the diacopy there was "remember." And then here's another one from my newsletter. I wrote, "Up until this moment, I tried not to think about opening night at all. Tried not to think of a theater full of people watching us, watching me perform." So I threw two into one sentence here. I did "tried not to think" and then "watching." So the first one was, "Tried not to think about opening night at all. Try not to think of a theater full of people." And then I did "watching us, comma, watching me perform." And, you know, it's a little different than I normally write, but I had so much fun doing it. And it was really pretty easy to write this way. And now that I know how it feels to read them, because reading her writing, I was so attracted to these lines. So now that I know that as a reader, it feels good to read these, why not write them? Why not use them all the time? Maybe not all the time, but you know, we'll see. We'll see how much I want to use them from now on. All right, here's another one where she did the diacopy "every other." Let me read this to you. On page 141, she wrote, "Tomorrow, we'll deal with it tomorrow. We'll deal with it when things get better." So she wrote, "Tomorrow, then deal with it, then tomorrow, and then deal with it." It's very sing-songy. "Tomorrow. We'll deal with it tomorrow. We'll deal with it when things get better." So I tried to do this too. In my newsletter from today, I wrote, "There were too many eyes on me in a moment when I was too close to tears, in a moment when the director was telling me, telling everyone, that I didn't have any place on that stage." So I did two and then "in a moment," then two and then "in a moment." And then I did another diacopy at the end with "telling," telling me, telling everyone. So I'll read it one more time. "There were too many eyes on me in a moment when I was too close to tears, in a moment when the director was telling me, telling everyone, that I didn't have any place on that stage." It's fun, isn't it? Okay. So he talks in the book, Mark Forsyth talks in the book about another form of diacopy called an elaboration, where you throw in an adjective. So his examples from the book are "From Sea to Shining Sea," "Sunday, Bloody Sunday," "Oh, Captain, My Captain." So this is my final passage from the book that I thought this was such a beautiful passage. So let me read this to you. On page 6, she writes, I wanted a beer, just one beer, to help me ease the headache, and I debated with myself about that for several long minutes. Shouldn't I prove to myself that I could go a day, just one simple day, without a drink? Shouldn't I? And then a little bit further down the page, I had the beer, and then when I got back to my apartment, I had a little wine with dinner. Just a little, two glasses, but they were small ones, so I considered them half glasses and counted them as one. So at the top, she writes, I wanted a beer, just one beer. So the elaboration is just. And then later on, I could go a day, just one simple day. So just and simple there. And then I had a little wine, just a little. It's like you can't even believe, I couldn't even believe like how repetitive it is with these diacopes and how effective it was. So I started adding these in my newsletter this week and I got a little diacopy happy. And for my book, I think this might be something I attack in my Taylor Swift draft. What's a Taylor Swift draft, you ask? I couldn't even say that without laughing. My Taylor Swift draft is the draft, the final draft, you know, it's like my last pass on the book where I make it sing. And I feel like that makes sense to add this kind of stuff at the end, but I'm not sure. Maybe this will be something that I add as I go. I'm not sure. So here's one more repetition thing that Caroline Knapp did in her book. And I wrote like with question marks, like, is this a diacopy? Because I'm not sure. But she did this thing where she writes a quote, where she repeats a quote three times. I don't think it's the same thing as a diacopy, but it reminded me of it. So I'm going to talk about it here because I really like this thing that she does. So here she's writing about her ex-boyfriend, Julian, and then her current boyfriend, Michael. And so on page 214, she writes, Julian and I left the party shortly after that. I drove. The car was weaving all over the road. He asked, are you all right? Do you want me to drive? I said, I'm fine. I only had two glasses of wine. I was always saying that. I only had two glasses of wine. Michael laughs about that now, the way I'd stagger into his living room at 9 or 10 o'clock at night and say, I am so tired. I can't believe how tired I am. I only had two glasses of wine. There's just something about this last line that when she said it, she'd already said it twice before, but the third time I just laughed out loud and I read this and I was like, oh my God, this is the David Sedaris trick. Do you guys remember? I talked about this in the Santaland Diaries. I can't like, how many times am I going to quote the Santaland Diaries? Like, it's such a great essay. So in the Santaland Diaries, David Sedaris writes, she said, I'm going to have you fired. I had two people say that to me today. I'm going to have you fired. Go ahead, be my guest. I'm wearing a green velvet costume. It doesn't get any worse than this. Why do these people, who do these people think they are? I'm going to have you fired. And I wanted to lean over and say, I'm going to have you killed. So in his little paragraph here, he says, I'm going to have you fired three times. And it's so fucking funny. Caroline says, I only had two glasses of wine and it's so fucking funny. So I did try to do this in my newsletter and I know it didn't work because as I was trying to figure out how to explain it to you, I realized I had to give you too much context. And with Caroline and David, all I had to do was read it and it is funny and that's how it should be. But I took a stab at it and I'm going to share it with you because I just want you to see what it was like to make the attempt. So the line that I repeated was, yeah, well, I'm just working with what I have. In this paragraph, I am having a conversation with my theater director, Paul. So I wrote, what came out of me next was an exasperated laugh. No, Paul, I'm not mad, I said. I'm trying to help you, he said. Yeah, well, I'm just working with what I have. Well, it's not good enough. I can viscerally remember the moment I said, yeah, well, I'm just working with what I have. There were too many eyes on me in a moment when I was too close to tears, in a moment when the director was telling everyone, that I didn't have any place on that stage. It was one thing to battle the voice in my head, but I could not come face to face with an actual person telling me the very thing I was so afraid of, that I wasn't supposed to be here. So I diverted my eyes to the floor, got angry, and said, yeah, well, I'm just working with what I have. So I repeated the line three times. It didn't have that punch at the end of like being funny, but I did have, I really, when I first wrote this newsletter, I didn't write this whole thing about how I felt about that thing that I said. Yeah, well, I'm just working with what I have. In the first pass, I just wrote it and I moved on to the next thing. But I really wanted to get across how cringy that moment felt for me. And what else was going on for me. And so I channeled my inner Caroline Knapp here and that was my attempt. Okay, the fourth term we are going to talk about today is parataxis. this was one of those like holy shit moments for me. I cannot even tell you how excited I am about Parataxis. And when I tell you about Parataxis, you're going to be like, this is not a big deal. but hold on. This gets really good. Okay. So Parataxis, Mark Forsyth describes in Elements of Eloquence as good, plain English, the natural way of speaking English. And this is like writers like Orwell and Hemingway. They used very simple, plain English and usually short sentences where you remove conjunctions. So instead of writing a sentence that has the word and in it, you would just take out the and write two short sentences. I'm not really familiar with Orwell, actually. I know I should read 1984 and I still haven't, but I am familiar with Hemingway. So I get it. Now, I have no problem with Parataxis in general, but I do think that it gets a little bit like choppy, a little bit boring to write like that all the time. But here is what gets really fucking cool. Caroline Knapp was selective with her Parataxis. And I noticed that she used Parataxis when she wrote about the moment when she found out her dad died, and then later the moment that her mom died. So she used it in these very particular moments. That was very cool. And I'm going to read these examples to you and you'll get what I'm talking about. On page 51, she writes, "Maybe we would have gotten there faster if I hadn't been drinking. If I'd been more alert, better able to throw off on my clothes and jump into the car. I can't say. But my father died before we got to the house. Andy met us at the door. He looked at me and said, about 2 minutes ago. I was still drunk." Okay, so it's this last part that's the Parataxis. "But my father died before we got to the house, period. Andy met us at the door, period. He looked at me and said, about 2 minutes ago, period. I was still drunk, period." So it's very matter of fact. It's short, it's choppy, it's plain speak, and it hit me in the gut. She was not there when her father died because she was drunk. And when she found out he was dead, she was drunk. Like, this is heavy shit. And she just says it with Parataxis. And because she says it with Parataxis, it's so much more powerful. And then she does it again when she talks about her mom's death. Ready? On page 208, she writes, "She died at about 1 p.m. My glass of wine was on the night table beside her bed. I picked it up as soon as I let go of her hand." Okay, let me just point out the Parataxis here. "She died at about 1 p.m., period. My glass of wine was on the night table beside her bed, period. I picked it up as soon as I let go of her hand, period." Like, your mom died and you take a sip of wine? Your mom died and you've got a glass of wine on the bedside table while she's dying? Like, what? That's crazy. And so she uses Parataxis for these like shocking and cringy admissions. And this, I just think that this is so, so huge. I hope you guys I wonder if you guys are as excited about this as I am. So let me like try to bring this into my own writing. I have a draft for the prologue of my book. So I'm going to read you this opening sentence of my book. And this is, you know, before I learned about Parataxis. So here's the opening line of my book, tentatively. "I'd stolen Adderall from my friend's stash for nearly a year, but this time I snatched the whole bottle, and when she asked if I'd seen it, I told her no." Okay, so that's what I wrote. So then, when I have Parataxis, here's how I might edit it. "I'd stolen Adderall from my friend's stash for nearly a year. This time I snatched the whole bottle. When she asked if I'd seen it, I told her no." Okay, so that was my attempt. I'm not sure if it works, mostly because I'm not sure if it works as well with a first sentence. If, you know, because I liked how, you know, Caroline introduced this on, you know, not till page 51 that she used it. So I was already in this like very like pretty flow with all of her repetition and all that kind of stuff. And then she punches you with the Parataxis. So it's kind of jarring to the way she was already writing. And so to open with Parataxis, I'm not sure if it's going to have the same effect. But anyway, I just wanted to try and see. All right, we are at the last term, which is pleonasm. Pleonasm is spelled P-L-E-O-N-A-S-M. And pleonasm is the use of unneeded words that are... this is how he describes it in the book. Let me read this to you because it's so fucking funny. Okay, so this is Mark Forsyth in Elements of Eloquence. He writes, "Pleonasm is the use of unneeded words that are superfluous and unnecessary in a sentence that doesn't require them. It's repeating the same thing again twice, and it annoys and irritates people. Some people cannot see a neoplasm without flying into a furious rage." I need to break this down for you because this chapter on pleonasm in the book was my favorite chapter. I thought it was the funniest one. So he is giving this definition and he says it's unneeded words that are superfluous and unnecessary. Well, superfluous and unnecessary mean the same thing. So that is a neoplasm. You don't need to write superfluous and unnecessary, but he did. And then he says, repeating the same thing again twice. Well, repeating the same thing is all you have to say. You don't need to say again or twice because that's what repeating is. And then he says, it annoys and irritates people. Well, annoys and irritates means the same thing. You could just write one. And then he says, fly without flying into a furious rage. Well, a rage, I think, is furious. So I don't think you need to describe a rage as furious. So really fucking funny how he uses pleonasm to write the definition of pleonasm. And so Mark says that there's three different types. He says the tiny, the lazy, and the lovely. So the tiny, here are some examples from the book that he wrote. Lift up, fall down, enter into, dearly beloved, gather together, join together. Okay, so if you think about those, you can see you don't need to say up, you can just say lift. You don't need to say down, you could just say fall. You don't need to say enter into, you just say enter. You get the picture. You know, these are not as offensive to me, but I get it. And then the lazy pleonasm, he says, is with an adjective and a noun. So here are some examples from the book that he wrote. Personal friends, added bonuses, free gifts. Again, when you think about it, it's like, yeah, friends are personal. Bonuses are added. Gifts are free. Like, why do you need to put those two words together? You don't. So he writes, the reason usually given for such anger is that the unnecessary word is wasting the reader's time, as though anybody's time were so valuable that reading the word up might mess up their schedule. I laughed when I read this line because up until reading this, I have fully agreed with it. You are wasting the reader's time and you shouldn't be redundant with your repetition. But what I learned from pleonasm is that pleonasm is being intentionally redundant. And when you are intentionally redundant, it's beautiful and it works. So let's get into the lovely neoplasm. I don't know if he made these up, but he says, we are all casual creatures and we say things that we don't really mean. So when we really mean a thing, we say it twice or three times. So it's this intentional redundancy for effect. And then a little bit later, he writes, pleonasm is absolutely natural and absolutely necessary. That is a pleonasm right there. He used the word absolutely twice. He could have just said, pleonasm is absolutely natural and necessary, but he wanted to nail it home. So he wrote, it's absolutely natural and absolutely necessary. And that also makes it a prettier and more memorable sentence. So let's get into an example from Caroline's book. For some reason, I don't have the page number for this, but she writes, when you drink, you can't do that. You can't make the distinction between getting through painful feelings and getting away from them. All you can do is just sit there, numb and sipping, numb and drunk. So numb and sipping, numb and drunk. When I first read that, I was like, huh, that's weird that she said numb twice. But if she took out the numb, it would be numb and sipping and drunk. And it just didn't land as much that way. Numb and sipping, numb and drunk. Let's look at another one. On page 5, she writes, I was 33 and I was drinking way too much and I was miserable and there had to be a connection. So she doesn't need to write I was every time. She could just write, I was 33 and drinking way too much and miserable and there had to be a connection. You know, and that works. And that is this, you know, the art of compression, which is something, by the way, that I'm a huge proponent of. I'm always chopping my stuff down. I'm trying to make my message as clear and concise as possible with as few words as possible. And now this is making me completely change my thought about that. Here's another one. On page 145, she writes, you hang out with other drinkers, people who find it perfectly desirable and perfectly normal to down 6 bottles of wine in a single sitting, people who support both the effort and the denial of its consequences. So people who and perfectly. So let me say it again. People who find it perfectly desirable and perfectly normal. You know, she could have just said perfectly desirable and normal. She didn't need to say perfectly twice. And then she writes people who twice. People who find it perfectly desirable. And then people who support both the effort and the denial of its consequences. All right, so there is another kind where you're not just repeating the exact thing, but you're saying the same thing in a different way with different words, but it's still redundant. So let me give you an example. On page 99, she writes, I kept writing about my need for a sense of purpose in my life, and I believed, or hoped, that this feeling would simply arrive, descend from above in the form of the right career or the right set of friends or the right relationship. Okay, so I know you guys all heard right in there. Right career, right set of friends, right relationship. But you might have missed the other one. She says that this feeling would simply arrive, comma, descend from above. Arrive and descend from above are essentially the same thing. She did not need to write both of those. She could have just picked one. And this made me think, you know how sometimes you hear something and it doesn't resonate, but then someone else says something in a different way and all of a sudden you get it? What she's doing in her writing is she's finding different ways into our psyche through different words and different phrases until something clicks for us. It forces me to sit longer with those ideas and with those thoughts because it's taking me longer to read it and therefore longer to process it and understand it. So how genius is that to hold the reader's hand through exactly what you're trying to get across? Here's another one. On page 150, she writes, "When he dropped me off, all he said was, 'Take care of yourself.' I didn't hear from him again, and although I felt responsible and humiliated on some core level, I also couldn't absorb the responsibility, couldn't face it." Okay, so this at the end is a pleonasm and a diacopy. So couldn't is the diacopy. Couldn't absorb the responsibility, couldn't face it. Well, it's also a pleonasm because couldn't absorb the responsibility is the same thing as saying couldn't face it. She didn't need to write both. But because she did, it's really just like, I feel it deeper inside me when she says it twice in different ways. Like, I really get it. Here's one more. She's talking about AA. On page 174, she writes, "I left the minute the meeting ended. I think I knew I wouldn't go back, but I promised myself, really promised myself, that I'd stop drinking so much, that I'd cut down, get it under control." So again, we've got another diacopy and a pleonasm. So the diacopy here is, I promised myself, really promised myself. And then the pleonasm, stop drinking so much that I'd cut down, get it under control. If you think about it, all three of those things mean the same thing. Stop drinking so much, cut down, get it under control. She could have just said that I'd stop drinking so much, but she says all three. I was like all turned around reading this book because as I was reading, I was recognizing like in my, because I was enjoying the book so much, but I was also recognizing like, oh wow, she's being pretty redundant. She's repeating a lot of the same things. She's saying the same things in different ways. And I was enjoying it. I was like, why is this working? Why do I like this? And so hopefully I was able to get that across to you guys today, like why this pleonasm work, why this redundant repetition, this intentional redundant repetition is so effective. And now I'm just like, I'm really excited about incorporating all this stuff into my writing. So to recap, the terms of rhetoric that we use today, which is making us all more intelligent people, right? I mean, I feel so smart now. We've got anaphora, where you repeat at the beginning of a word or of a clause, sentence, or paragraph. Epistrophe is the opposite, where you end the clause, sentence, or paragraph with the same words. Diacopy, where you repeat the word or phrase after a brief interruption. Parataxis is that plain speak, and what she did with it was she used it in these really intense, cringy, or shockworthy moments. And then pleonasm is this intentional redundant repetition where you say the same thing over for effect, or you say the same thing in a different way for effect. That is it. The reason why, the other of many reasons why I love this book was because Caroline Knapp captured the way I felt about drinking in a way that I've never read or been able to articulate for myself. And everything she wrote, I was just like, oh my God, yes. I was addicted to this book. I could not put it down. I read it so fast. And when I finished this book, I was just like thinking that it was the content. I was like, I need to read all the sobriety memoirs because this was so good. So I ordered all these books. I got The Night of the Gun by David Carr. I got The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober by Catherine Gray. I got We Are the Luckiest by Laura McCowan. And I got to tell you guys, none of them resonated with me as much as this one. And so I put those books aside because I gave it a go, and they just, you know, they just weren't as good as Drinking a Love Story. And so then I realized after three sobriety memoirs that maybe I don't need to read another sobriety memoir. Maybe I need to read another Caroline Knapp memoir. And so I looked it up, and she has one more. She also has a collection of essays, but, you know, and I'm sure I would love the collection of essays, but that's not really going to be helpful for me as I write my own memoir. So the other memoir is called Pack of Two. And I read the summary, and I was just like, well, I don't really want to read this, because it's about her getting a dog after she became sober and after her parents died. And it's all about her relationship with her dog and the general idea of people with their relationships with dogs. And I'm just like, I don't have a dog. I'm not really a dog person. Like, I mean, I like them. Don't get me wrong. Like, dogs are cute, and I'll play with a puppy, but I wasn't really like it wasn't really speaking to me to read an entire book about the relationship of people and dogs. But I just love her writing so much. And I realized that after I, you know, tried these other three books, that I missed Caroline. And it's really sad, because she will not be writing any more books. She died of lung cancer in 2002 at age 42. And I wish that there was more of her writing out there. But I did order Pack of Two, and I started reading it last night, and it's really beautiful. She's just a beautiful writer. So I am not sure what I'm going to do, because there were definitely things I learned from the other three books that I just told you about, even though I didn't finish them. And then there were some things that I didn't like that I really actually do want to share with you as what didn't work and why I didn't like them and what I don't want to replicate in my own book. So that might be worth sharing, or I'll just, you know, read this Pack of Two book and want to talk about that. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what my next memoir deep dive will be, but I am sure that whatever I choose to cover, whatever I choose to talk about, I will be fired up about it.